Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to increase major planned and principal giving. QBAC acts as a force multiplier for fundraisers, enabling them to focus on what they do best, developing deep relationships with prospects and cultivating them into lifelong donors. QBAC automates the qualification process beyond simple scoring to ensure that your fundraisers have the best prospects. QBAC also uncovers actionable insights about current and future prospects to help fundraisers develop personalized cultivation strategies. Start closing bigger gifts in less time by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. Also, how about being our next host for the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow? I'm looking forward to two things this summer: getting back to the ballpark with my kids and getting the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow back on the calendar. If your organization would like to be a host location, let's schedule a time to chat. The Responsive Fundraising Roadshow provides 6 hours of the best fundraising training out there based on Responsive's 4 sense-making tools. Hosting Responsive's Roadshow is not like hosting a major conference that requires months of planning and all types of resources. All we need you to do is provide us with a safe learning environment for 25 adult professionals in your community who want to understand how highly effective fundraising really works. There is no cost to your organization, and we will reimburse you for all related expenses. If your organization would like to host the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow in your community, reach out and let's have a conversation today. Hi, Alex. I am delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast today. I have been looking at the stuff that you and the team at Open have put together, and I'm looking forward to unraveling that or diving into it or whatever the right expression is. But before we do that today, Alex, how about we just let you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Hi, Jason. Thank you so much for having me. It's really exciting to be here. I'm really looking forward to having a chat, and it's my first time on a podcast, which is very exciting. So I'm Alex Srivastav, and I work at Open Creates. So we are a strategy and creative agency based in London, but we work globally. So we have charity clients all over the world in different territories. And we have most recently been working on the Charity Benchmarks COVID-19 Impact Monitor, looking at the impact that COVID has had on a quarterly basis on charities, specifically in the UK.
So before we dive into that, and I certainly want to, that's going to be the focus of our attention, but it doesn't sound like you're a charity person, that you're not a nonprofit person. So how does a person like yourself maybe land up in the charity space?
Oh, so I actually started as a charity person.
Okay, there you go.
So I studied. I fell into it, as I think most people do, into fundraising. But I studied international relations at university, and then managed to get any job at Save the Children in London. I just applied for anything that they would have me for, and I ended up in a temp role at Save the Children, and then I managed to get into their direct marketing team and kind of worked my way through an individual giving in direct marketing at Save the Children UK.
Yeah.
Which was really fascinating. And then I moved around a little bit within the sector of different organizations based in London. So all international development, strangely. So Save the Children, ActionAid, and UNICEF. And then I did a little bit of time at a startup. So I worked at an ed tech startup for a little bit, which was fascinating, and lots of interesting stuff as kind of product is becoming, you know, a huge thing in individual giving in the UK, and I'm sure in the States as well, and all over the world. And then I had been actually a client of Opens, the agency I now work for, at various charities that I worked at before. So yeah, it was a great move to come and work for them after that.
Yeah.
So I'm a charity girl at heart, really.
Well, the report that you all put together came across my radar. I pay attention to that stuff because I get the privilege of oftentimes interviewing people that put together things like that here on the podcast, and I paid attention to it. It was very quality stuff. And I think why it most interested me is I've got a pretty good read on sort of what's playing out here in the U.S. and perhaps a little bit in Canada as it relates to COVID and what all that has looked like. Like we had a large number of people right in the middle of the summer last year from Canada, just talking about sort of the COVID reality and so forth. But honestly, I have not gotten a read, nor have my listeners been able to get a read on what's happening in the United Kingdom. So that's why this is of interest to me. So tell us a little bit about the research, and then let's just unravel it.
Absolutely. So should mention, I work for Open, but we also work with a freestyle marketing on this report. So I just must get Alan Freeman's name in there as well, because he works with us on this. So it's Open Creates and Freestyle Marketing. So for a couple of years before I joined Open, they did an annual benchmarked report. So there are older reports that looked at kind of annual trends in the UK fundraising market, so across the kind of fundraising piece. But this year we realized that an annual look is probably not going to be, it's not going to cut the mustard in terms of what people really want to see and that ability to see data, you know, faster.
Yeah.
So we switched to a quarterly view. So the report that we've released so far, we're working on the next one. It looks at, yeah, what has happened in fundraising income, expenditure, staffing levels, strategy throughout 2019 and throughout 2020 to Q3. That's where the data we had, where we published the last report was. So we can compare year on year, 2019 to 2020. But I think what's really interesting, you know, there are other benchmarking things out there, and there's lots of different ways to cut it. But what we've been able to do with the help of our participant organizations, which has been amazing, is look at kind of quantitative and qualitative, that word always catches me, look at both sides of that data. We also did some interviews with kind of directors of fundraising to get kind of more you know, conversational feedback about what's happening. We've got staffing levels, fundraising costs. So there's a real depth, I think, in this data, which allows us to kind of, you know, we try not to draw conclusions so much, but to highlight trends and interesting features that people might find interesting. So yeah, it's been fascinating. It's been absolutely fascinating, and I think a real labor of love for a lot of us over here.
So before we sort of go deep dive into it, on the back end, do you feel good about things, or are you like, oh my gosh, this, we're just never going to get out of the dark on this one?
I think my colleagues. So at kind of back end, we did we sent some forms for people to fill in, you know, kind of finance people helped fill in some forms, some, you know, leaders from across fundraising filled in some forms. And then I also did some interviews, and then I reported back to kind of my colleagues at Open before we wrote the report. And actually one of the big things that almost everyone said when we came out of that meeting was, this is a lot more positive than we were expecting. And obviously the bottom has fallen out of some really, really important areas of fundraising. And the toll on people has obviously been outrageous. It's been awful in a lot of ways. But actually, I think and remembering that those interviews were done in kind of November time, October, November time. So in the UK, we'd had a period of slight lockdown easing before then, and then it all crashed around us again after those interviews had taken place. But I think it was quite interesting. We'd kind of been in this really difficult position, and then everyone had been able to take stock maybe of the last 6 months slightly. Obviously, everyone was still chasing their tails a little bit. But it was interesting that lots of people were kind of talking about to give you an example, they were talking about things like, it's giving us an opportunity to do things differently, mm-hmm. and we needed to do things differently anyway. Mm-hmm. So actually, we'll use this as a catalyst, and that is a positive outcome of a really awful situation. So it was great to see that you know, a number of people in the sector had picked up on that, which was excellent. So yeah, it wasn't as doom and gloom as you may have feared.
Do you think, I have been reading for quite some time, John Hagel is a researcher on the West Coast here in the U.S., in the Silicon Valley. And he has been talking about for the last, probably the more than a decade, he's been talking about what he calls the big shift. And the big shift is this sort of just universal worldwide shift of going from what he refers to as a world that is sort of guided by scalable efficiency to a world that is sort of guided by scalable learning. And so we have to start just existing in this constant learning mode. And so rather than constantly sort of exploiting what we know, we have to just constantly explore what we don't know. And it sounds like, if I'm reading between the lines of what you just said, and if I'm reflecting on what I have heard probably several times from guests here in the U.S., for example, it's that COVID has done us all the fortunate benefit of maybe in our sector, in the nonprofit sector, of sort of flipping the switch on that transition. Does that make sense to you? I mean, is that essentially what people were telling you, is that we have been riding this train for so long, this scalable efficiency train, and it has been hitting diminishing returns. We've hit that diminishing return so many times, and we didn't know how we were going to make it. And then all of a sudden COVID comes along and makes us stop and realize that maybe we were just needed to, you know, almost like get off the train and get on another one. Is that kind of what you heard?
Absolutely. And I think that comes out in many ways, which it was fascinating to go through. So one of the previous report we did looked at 2019. So that was the last annual kind of benchmarks report.
Yeah.
And one of the big themes that came out of that was something that we dubbed the burning platform, which is exactly what you've just described. We referred to it as the burning platform, but it's exactly what you've just said. So one of the questions I asked in the interviews was, has that changed? And the answer was absolutely not, but this is the catalyst. So that's, I completely agree with what you've just said. And in some of the ways that seems to have played out in maybe some more of the detail, so some leaders, for example, spoke about streamlining processes. So perhaps, you know, in this world of needing to be more innovative and being more reactive, so, you know, that constant state of learning that you've just described, actually having 15 people sign off a piece of content or communication or creative before it gets out the door is not very sensible. And so, you know, streamlining those processes and maybe getting more into what a charity, you know, for example, in an international development organization in an emergency, you have different processes for that. You know, if you're trying to get a direct marketing appeal, you know, trying to get a TV ad out because there's just been this horrific earthquake and you want to make people aware of it and raise money straight away, mm-hmm. you don't go through the normal processes of sign off. This is just one example of sign off.
Yeah.
And so you streamline those things and you say, actually, who is essential to see this before it leaves the building? And they're the people that see it. And so some organizations, some leaders kind of spoke about that kind of change, so streamlining processes, which is really critical. Others spoke about restructuring. And actually, I found the conversations around restructuring really fascinating because I think a lot of people said, we either restructured just before COVID or we are restructuring, but the structure we're implementing hasn't been impacted by COVID. Yeah. It's just been hastened. And those who I spoke to a couple of people who'd restructured just before COVID hit, or they had made the design just before COVID hit. And all of them said they wouldn't have changed anything with the benefit of hindsight if it had been post COVID. So this idea of, you know, being more integrated, busting silos, bringing, whether it's brand and fundraising together, all of those kinds of themes. And obviously, lots of organizations had lots of thoughts on what the right structure was. But all of them suggested that COVID didn't change them. It just brought them forward. And so they're finally, they're getting off that train a bit quicker than they would have been allowed to before.
Is getting off, did you notice in your research, because I'm just reflecting on, I'm drawing some conclusions about perhaps what I've read of Hegel's stuff, is the idea that getting off that train, for example, is going to be, or always has, because he's been looking at this stuff for like more than a decade, like I said, is far harder for these larger institutions that are not as nimble, not as adaptable. They can't move through that bureaucracy any quicker than, the institution itself is designed for a very predictable world where efficiency works and not a world where the world literally changes overnight. And so, Alex, when you're looking at the data that you all have looked at over the last several months, even the last year, all of this data, are you seeing organizations those that were smaller were also more adaptive and nimble and able to respond? Or did they have the advantage of that? And is it the larger institutions that are struggling?
Interestingly, that theme didn't come out. And it's probably worth caveating that the research, the report that's already been published, uh-huh. It's 15 organizations. Okay. So it's not a huge number.
It's not a big set.
It's household names, but it's 15.
Yeah.
And we're currently working on the next report that looks at Q4 as well. And that has about 10 additional organizations in it. And none of the trends have changed. Obviously, the numbers have shifted where we've added organizations.
Yeah.
But none of the trends have changed. But I think in terms of size, I think it's a double-edged sword, because I think I imagine this is the same in most markets. But it's certainly same. It's certainly true in the UK. Bigger organizations may have had the opportunity to invest in an innovation function before this had happened.
Okay.
And so I think, and this is my opinion here, I'm not sure that the data necessarily tells us this, but I'm post-rationalizing that that there wasn't a big discrepancy between sizes, because small organizations may have been more nimble, but may not have had the right skill set in house. Whereas larger organizations, even though they had to cut through that bureaucracy and cut that red tape, as you've described, maybe had an innovation function as it stood, and so they were just able to kind of be braver and push forward. But one of the things I think that came out of the interviews, in particular, obviously this is harder to see in a data set, is the interactions with trustees. And that was a really interesting theme. So a lot of people we spoke to spoke about trustees maybe starting to get it. Not that all trustees didn't before, but I think, you know, there's been a long, I don't know what the right words are. It's not long fought battle, but, you know, a long process with trustees in organizations to maybe understand mass fundraising. And, you know, you put all this money in up top, and then, you know, in 5 years time you get this great return. You know, thinking about things like organizations that have got big DRTV programs and stuff like that, where that initial investment is substantial. And so I think organizations found that those who had invested in individual giving, for example, regular giving programs, where they had that consistent income from years of investing in regular giving, maybe felt vindicated.
Yeah.
And that helped with trustee trust. And I also think that all of this has just brought to the fore the issues within fundraising and what needs to happen, what needs to change, and what makes fundraising sustainable, which is diversification. And if you're just constantly, you know, optimizing around the sides, and if every year your budget is slightly reduced but your income targets are slightly increased, you don't have the opportunity to do something radical, because you're beholden to these numbers that get increasingly hard to deliver. That, you know, there was this feeling that maybe that chain could be broken, and that trustees were maybe more understanding. Obviously, that's a wildly sweeping statement. But an interesting theme that did come out.
Okay, so I can't overlook that you said brave, because I always listen to qualitative terms like bravery. Are we going to be braver on the other side of this? Are we just going to be braver people and braver fundraisers, and perhaps know that the world is, you know, one of the things I've been writing a lot about for this new book project is the fact that, you know, last two decades for most of the professional careers and most of the people that are sort of driving fundraising decisions right now, we've experienced three very unpredictable events in the last two decades, starting with September 11th and then with the recession and now with COVID-19. And I think COVID-19 might have been experienced in such a way where, like, to sort of piece together, we've been through this once, we've been through this twice, this is also very different. Every time is going to sort of throw us a different sort of curveball. And now we're going to be a little braver and we're going to know that the world is unpredictable and fundraising practices might be a little different. What do you think?
I hope so. I hope so. And I think if the recession, I mean, I joined fundraising at the end of the recession in the UK. So I joined fundraising in 2011,
yeah,
I think it was.
Right. Okay.
And so the recession really bit in 2008, didn't it? So, so I think what I kind of know from colleagues and kind of from seeing in my kind of early career is that organizations who managed to spend through that recession ultimately won. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are organizations who, you know, went into survival mode and that really negatively impacted their fundraising and still negatively impacts them now, you know, a long time after that, a relatively long time after that. And so I really hope that that is the case. And, you know, I'm going to quote something really cringy now, but we have a very old, very classic TV program here called Only Fools and Horses. I don't know if you know it at all, but yeah, there is a line in there, is that he who dares wins. I think that's exactly the case with this. And I think, you know, it doesn't mean blindly spend on fundraising. Of course it doesn't. But I think, and, you know, small, even tactical tests at this point are absolutely critical to shore up your fundraising for the future.
And is that sort of the red flag in the research that you've been looking at and as you're sort of, you know, the idea that, give me that phrase again,
he who dares wins.
He who dares wins. I mean, if you think about that, that's sort of that underlying, I mean, that's what I teach an entrepreneurship class, social entrepreneurship class at the local college, for example. And that's essentially what we know to be sort of the way that the world works, is those who sort of take a risk oftentimes are often the ones who experience the greatest reward. And perhaps what the silver lining in all this is that he who dares wins. I mean, is that sort of really what, in some ways, is that what the red flag was in some of your findings, that those who wouldn't dare are the ones who are perhaps now or going to be a year from now really sort of struggling to, what I think it was your report. If it wasn't your report, it was another report that was, I think there was another headline recently that I read about the same time I read yours, that it's a lot of the organizations we need to be most concerned about are the ones that we're not even going to know are in serious distress for like another 18 to 24 months.
Yeah, I think, to be honest, the empirical data that we've looked at, it's too early to tell.
Yeah.
So I can't say that looking at that report, you know, I can clearly point to organizations who are going to win and those who are going to lose. But that's absolutely not the case.
Yeah.
And the report showed us product areas, you know, have been the winners and losers. And some of those are in very, you know, just common sense terms. So anything that required face-to-face interaction, obviously, the bottom fell out of. So, you know, retail collapsed. And between Q2 2019 and Q2 2020, there was a 90% drop in income from charity shops because they were shut and there weren't people on the high street and, you know, it was illegal to go to them. But then you see, we saw a huge increase in emergency fundraising.
Yeah.
So something, I think this is really interesting, the domestication of emergency fundraising in the UK, and I'm sure it's similar in other markets, including the US, is traditionally we had seen emergency fundraising as something that was done by international development organizations. Mm-hmm. And the emergencies were, you know, climate emergencies or, you know, earthquakes, things like that. And we saw charities in the UK who were domestic charities who had never launched an emergency style appeal going out, being brave,
yeah,
going out with something like that.
Yeah.
and the public responding in the most inspiring way, and, you know, income being absolutely phenomenal. So I think it may be too broad to categorize braveness part, you know, by organization. I think within opportunities, there is a level of bravery to take that step into the unknown, even if it's not unknown for the sector, but the unknown for that organization.
Yeah.
To allow themselves to get in front of, you know, relevant audiences. And I also think this is going to sound really obvious, but relevance is the key issue, isn't it? So you can be brave and stupid.
Right.
Not that I think any of my colleagues, you know, in the UK charity sector are, absolutely not, but, you know, theoretically you could do that.
I think that's what we call arrogance, right? Pricks, as American. Yeah, wow. We've gotten a lot of those.
Obviously you need to be brave, but you also need, you know, the insight and the strategy behind it, whether that's reactive and fairly tactical rather than, you know, a 2-year strategy that's pointing you in that direction. It could be something that you found an opportunity in last week, but if it aligns with your audience, if it puts, you know, if it brings what your organization does and what the audience wants together, then it's a sensible thing to do. So I think it's difficult to judge in overall terms. But hopefully I think being more reactive, and in a way that could be classed as being brave, you know, it is on the up, and hopefully will continue to be.
So it, you know, when I think about the conversations I have had since, So I think what is, I'm sort of hypothesizing here, but when I put out my first book 3 years ago and then started producing these podcast conversations, and I'm having more and more of these conversations, and I'm typically talking to a fundraising professional who's perhaps about 10 years in. They're about 10 years in. And one of the things I've wondered, and I'm wondering if any of your data sort of points at this, or maybe you picked up on this and maybe a conversation or two in there. I think there's a more savvy fundraising. So the actual fundraiser whose boots are on the ground inside these organizations, is there a more savvy fundraiser today that perhaps is picking up on the same things that perhaps an outside organization, like a research organization like yours, has historically been counted on to sort of uncover? Are you seeing the same fundraiser that sort of knows that they've either signed on with a shop that knows the hell what they're doing or that doesn't know what they're doing? Do you follow what I'm asking?
I think so, but I don't know if I can answer the question. I don't know. To be brutally honest, I don't know the answer to that. And I think some of the charity leaders we spoke to spoke about, giving people the opportunity to fail, and I think it harks back to that, the point I made about trustees kind of giving people the opportunity to fail. You know, you're not a failure if your innovation idea fails, yeah, because, you know, X number of out of 10 are going to, and that's part of innovation. That's part of the risk,
yeah,
that you accept as an organization. So I think organizationally, I certainly saw a trend the written responses we received, and also the interviews I took, that organizations are moving towards that kind of being less risk averse.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And that's kind of what that precipitated my thinking and my question. It was your comment about trustees, because I think there's a fundraiser out there today that did not, I think we're just savvier, smarter, better at this than a lot of us were. I mean, I repeatedly say on the podcast, everybody who listens knows that I say that fundraising is in its messy adolescence and it's growing up. And so it's becoming a profession that is parting ways with PR and marketing and advertising, figuring out its own stuff. And how does that translate into like your research and our conversation? It means that some of your fundraisers who perhaps would not have understood what's playing out if they were on the payroll, say during September 11th or during the recession, totally know whether or not their employer knows how to navigate this or not now. I guess what I'm saying is, and this is what I picked up when I had this very large group of Canadian fundraisers on the podcast last summer. I think these people were just better prepared to navigate this. Not because it was an uncertain, predictable thing and that they were able to figure it all out, but they just were more mature fundraisers. And so therefore they just knew how, they were just okay with, they knew how to figure this out. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that must be true of people who have been in the sector for, you know, 10 to 15 years. I think it must be true. And yeah, we definitely, you know, some of the people we work with are absolutely incredible at what they do. And, you know, I want to be stood next to them the next time something goes down. But I don't know if that's true of new fundraisers. Like, you know, I couldn't comment that. Maybe this is where I misinterpreted your question. Couldn't comment if someone who joined fundraising a year ago and has been in it a year is better than someone who joined 10 years ago when they were a year in.
No, I'm kind of getting at that 10 year. The person who was reading my book, for example, the person who was reading my first book was generally not the new fundraiser. It was the person who was 10 years in. And so they were, one of the things I'm constantly saying is that they're thinking more carefully and critically about the work that they do. So there's not as much, you know, if you think about the way fundraising has historically worked, it's largely been based on a lot of impulsivity of the, you know, and assumes a lot of assumptions about consumer behavior and so forth and so forth. But I think we're actually sort of wising up to the fact that fundraising maybe behaves a little differently and the donor motives are different and that our understanding of the world is different too. And so that person who's 10 or 12 years in, here's the thing. I think that there's a lot of people who are 10 or 12 years in that are very intrigued by I mean, it's the reason why I'm creating this conversation, because I think there's people who are 10 or 12 years in who are very intrigued with this information and know how to read between the lines and know how to translate their experiences through what type of information you're giving them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in a way, you know, what we do at Open, the agency I work for is a reflection of that. So, you know, we work in strategy and creative, but I think over speaking on behalf of an organization I wasn't working at during the time that I'm talking about, but the strategy function at Open has grown so significantly over the last 12 years. And it's because people, you know, our colleagues in charity want to know, who are my audience? What are they interested in? How can I meet them where they are? What is the difference? And what you've just described. And that's why what we offer as an organization, we still do incredible creative and that hasn't changed, but what's grown alongside it is that kind of strategy piece to help charities answer those questions that you've just described. So, you know, we want to launch something. We want to reach new audiences. Who should they be and what should that be with? And, you know, actually starting with the audience rather than, you know, this charity over there has launched a subscription product. I want one. We're given the opportunity to actually go back to the beginning and say, right, where is the opportunity for growth here?
Yeah.
And look at it, you know, in that really broad sense that actually offers the best return on investment ultimately, because you're going at it from, you know, you're coming at the question from the right position of what is going to work in our context for our audiences for what we deliver.
So did you find anything? I'm always interested when I'm talking to researchers. Did you find anything that like totally surprised you? Like you didn't expect to find that, and good, bad, or otherwise. But was there anything sort of this like wow that you didn't expect the data to tell you?
So there were obviously lots of things that weren't a surprise at all. So things like retail and events fundraising collapsing, not a surprise.
Yeah.
Things like emergency fundraising, ultimately not a surprise. It's really interesting that there was that domestication, but not a surprise. But there were other ways, there were other things that were. So one of them was around major giving. And actually, you know, I think inherently we know that in times of crisis, people step up and our supporters are our biggest asset, and there's no question about that. And over the last year, supporters have been incredible, and nearly everyone I've spoken to for this report have said that, you know, our supporters have just been with us like never before, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. And I'm really glad we can say that. And so for major giving, for example, major giving or philanthropy, you know, high net worth individual fundraising, whatever it might be labeled in whatever organization, because it changes, you know, not just the other side of the pond, but organization to organization, what we label things. But that might traditionally have been you know, driven by, it's relationships, isn't it? So it's, it could be face-to-face. It could be getting that meeting in. And obviously that's not been able to happen in the same way. And that face-to-face time has been very different with Zoom. But actually, you know, looking at some of the figures, so for major giving, between Q2 2019 and Q2 2020, if you compare the income in those two quarters, it grew by 143% in 2020. So some of those things I found really fascinating, because obviously that was the first time that maybe you hadn't been able to make the ask in person. And I'm making sweeping statements here, because I'm sure there were lots of asks made virtually before as well. But I thought that was really interesting. We also found that cash activity, so kind of appeals, whether they're mailed appeals, for example, did incredibly well. So it wasn't just emergency asks, you know, specific emergency asks that did really well, but any activity really that seemingly that went out during Q2, for example, when it really kicked off, did really, really well. So it wasn't necessarily that direct link to COVID that was required. It was just everyone was looking to help, which was amazing. So I don't know if that's surprising so much as just it like gives you a lot of faith in humanity. I'm really happy about it.
It's interesting that you talk about it. So I was in last time I was in the UK, I was speaking at an event out in, I was in Canterbury, and it was I think that was 2017. And at the time, there was sort of an interest, some of the, what I was talking about, so there was an interest in individual and major giving amongst a lot of the people that I was talking to. And it was very evident to me. I think what I was picking up on there, if I recall correctly, I didn't just sort of remembering, you know, you have this sort of the charity sector, and you have sort of this trust fund, you know, these old, very old trust-based fundraising sort of money. And it seemed like that fundraising in the UK was sort of waking up to the idea that they were interested in what I was saying, because I was coming from the US and perhaps Americans were assumed to be the ones who had figured out major giving or something. But maybe what we've now seen, and based on what you're just sort of suggesting is that we're actually seeing COVID as one of those first major places where, yeah, major giving and individual giving has really sort of stepped it up, and we know what we're doing now, and we don't have to keep asking these prick Americans who don't necessarily know it all, and we can kind of figure it out on our own. Does that make sense? Because it's not that, because I think there's a danger. I've never sort of said it this way, but I think there's a danger when you think about the way that mass market fundraising generally works, it's highly technical and it's done in large numbers. And sometimes we think that when we're doing major giving work, that we can sort of just translate a lot of those metrics and a lot of that just to it on a grander scale or the same scale and same methods, and just expect bigger checks. And it doesn't really work that way. It is a total qualitative turn in what you're doing. And I think that was part of what, when I remember some of those conversations, I was like, that's really all it is. It's you've just got to make sort of a qualitative turn towards, you know, it's not highly technical. And so it can't necessarily be taught. It almost just has to be learned. It's work that you learn in the field. It's not work that I can put in a technical manual. We have all these gurus here in the US who've tried to write books on major giving, when in fact, what major giving really is just learning how to perhaps have a meaningful conversation like you and I are. That's really all it comes down to. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I absolutely hope that that is coming to fruition. I think that, you know, that and there are incredible professionals here, of course, and I'm sure there are all over the globe. And one thing actually relating to that that I found really interesting was that the growth in major donor income, for example, between Q2 2019 and Q2 2020, it wasn't income per donor going up. It was actually more donors giving.
Yeah. Okay.
So I thought that was really interesting. So comparing 2019, where there were, and it, of course, it was because the need was more clearly evident.
Yeah.
And you know, it's probably easier to describe the need. And again, I'm not a major donor fundraiser, so I may be completely wrong there. But I imagine that is the case. And so being able to evidence that to a wider range of people, I thought was really interesting. So perhaps it didn't have an impact on how much people were giving. It actually impacted how many people were giving. And so whether they were completely new contacts or kind of lapsed contacts, however you might describe them at your organization, major donor fundraisers were convincing more people to give, which is really powerful, you know, rather than those relationships they already had, increasing their gift and, you know, encouraging them to give more, they were establishing new relationships, which I found, fascinating. Considering.
Yeah, and that's what I probably wanted to tell some. See, major, what I've oftentimes wanted to explain to people is look, when you're building a relationship with a major donor, whatever the hell major donor means, it's all contextual. And so you can't fly me over and let me teach you how to contextually raise money with people for whom you're actually going to be able to make a more meaningful connection with than I am. And it's sort of this emergent phenomenon that sort of comes as a result of the interaction. And so what COVID may have done for people who are now raising more significant gifts in larger numbers is it's just the outcome of doing the work and therefore learning the work, because you cannot teach. I've said this over and over again. You cannot teach, in my opinion, you can't teach major giving in a classroom, and I can't put it in a technical manual. You just have to go out and do it, learn how to communicate with people. And in the case of the UK, COVID gave you a great opportunity, and it actually gave you the uncomfortableness of that Zoom, because a lot of them were probably doing meetings on Zoom and platforms like this, where you just had to be completely vulnerable and listen and, you know, put your shiniest face on, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully that relevance was, you know, was increased by the fact that everyone knew that everyone was in dire straits, and you could, you know, everyone was so aware of what was happening with COVID, it maybe was easier for people to imagine what impact that was on an organization before even having that conversation to begin with, perhaps.
So, Alex, before I let you go, we lose our listeners at about 40 minutes, and you've given me some extraordinary stuff, and I'm very grateful, as I'm sure the rest of my listeners are, for you giving us sort of an update on where things are in the United Kingdom. But where do you think this is going to go? Like, you guys aren't stopping. This isn't your only report. It sounds like, as you started with, we're very optimistic about where things are going. It sounds like we have very brave fundraisers in the United Kingdom, as we do in other places. Where do you think this is going?
Well, we're currently crunching the numbers for Q4. So I know that's still in the past and you're asking about the future, but just to squeeze that in, we're going to have a new report out within the next month. So charitybenchmarks.org to get that updated Q4 report, which I've had a little sneak peek at the numbers of and looks really promising. And, you know, in the areas that were promising, it seems
Q4,
to be
that would be year in giving.
So that it's not financial year end here, but it's the calendar year end. So it's
Christmas.
Was it October to December?
Yeah,
it's Christmas.
Yeah, holiday giving, right. Exactly. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, holiday giving.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's really interesting, and I think helps give context, because obviously being able to compare an entire year to an entire year is far more illuminating than kind of three quarters to four quarters. So that's really important. I hope where it's going is that you know, charities continue to look after their people, and that was a big thing that came out, that charities were really concerned about looking after their fundraisers, and I hope that continues, and I'm sure it will, based on everything that I've read. And, you know, it's a really hard time to be a fundraiser with people losing jobs, or something called the furlough scheme here, which means you might not be working full time, which is really difficult. But I hope we continue to be, you know, a really vibrant group of people that can do, you know, have amazing impacts on the communities that we support, which is, you know, what we're all in it for. And I hope that continues, and that organizations empower those amazing people to be brave and, you know, try things that are right for their audiences and right for their organizations, and allow people, the public, to be involved in the amazing things that these charities are achieving.
Alex, it's been an extraordinary conversation. I'm very grateful for your time. You're always welcome back. Just as a quick reminder, how can people find this information? I'm going to put a link in the show notes, and I will certainly put some information on LinkedIn where we post this. But how can people find your reports? Tell us where the website is and those sorts of things. And you tell them so I don't botch it up.
Sure. So for the latest report, you can download it at charitybenchmarks.org. It will be updated with the latest report at the end of the month. And if you want to chat to us, it's Open Creates. Thank you so much for having me. And be very happy to continue this conversation another time or with any of your listeners. So thank you again.
Thank you, Alex.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.